sure which one of those last two talked faster.
Good morning. It's still morning. Take a minute to get settled. The next case on our calendar today is, in the last oral case, is State versus Gerald James Risk. Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument, followed by 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant after respondent's argument. If you can please introduce yourselves and the party you represent, we would appreciate that for the record. And you can proceed whenever you're ready. The podium is adjustable, if need be.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Gerald Risk. I would like to start by thanking the court for rescheduling this matter. This court's flexibility is greatly appreciated.
Hopefully you're feeling better today.
Much better. I think it's going to be a better morning for all of us. To begin with, I'd like to directly address the state's response to our argument regarding the misconduct, specifically the state's response that Mr. Risk's attorney somehow agreed that the evidence of child pornography could be admitted at his trial and that it was somehow strategic for Mr. Risk to admit this evidence at trial. To give a little background of the procedures that took place prior to trial, the police found multiple videos and photographs on Mr. Risk's phone. Judge Redding ruled that those were all inadmissible to come in at trial. Mr. Risk's attorney was very cautious about opening the door for those pictures and videos to come in at trial. He posed a hypothetical situation to the trial court and to the prosecutor regarding whether that would come in if he asked a question about child pornography. There was an agreement that if he first opened the door by asking if child pornography was found on his phone, then the state could then ask a limited question of whether there were items that were deleted from the phone. Mr. Risk's attorney did not open the door. He never asked that question. During the examination of the sergeant who searched the phone, the prosecutor on direct examination asked about the child pornography and then asked whether there were items that were deleted from the phone. So I want to make clear that there was nothing that Mr. Risk's attorney did that opened the door for any of this evidence to come in. There was no agreement that any of this evidence would come in. Mr. Risk's attorney only asked one single question of one witness regarding the child pornography allegation. So as the state argues that this was somehow part of his case, it's just simply not true. Rule 404B, the plain language of Rule 404B, makes clear that prior bad act evidence is inadmissible unless the prosecutor follows the specific procedures in 404B. In this case, the prosecutor filed two separate Spriegel motions and didn't include any request to include the child pornography allegation. It wasn't in the first motion that was filed before Judge Redding, and it wasn't in the second motion that was filed before Judge Quam. So the prosecutor admitted this evidence, referred to this evidence in direct examination of KT, in direct examination of the therapist, in direct examination of the sergeant, and during its cross-examination of Mr. Risk when he testified.
Is there ever an objection? Do you agree that this is a plain error analysis, Mr. Erickson?
Absolutely.
So looking at it in that context, and considering the pretrial discussions that were had with the judge regarding this alleged pornography, how can it be said that the judge plainly erred by not sua sponte stepping into this fray after it had been discussed with them to begin with in a pretrial fashion? You know, I think had there been objections, certainly then the analysis would be way different, but to say the judge should have stepped in and stopped things, considering the way the parties had framed the issues for him, how can we say that that was plain error on behalf of that trial judge?
Because when we look at plain error, we look at whether there is a law or case that specifically says that you cannot do what happened. In this case, Rule 404B specifically says to be admissible, the prosecutor must follow 404B. So it's a plain error to not follow 404B.
Right, but there could have been an objection, Judge. That violates Rule 404B. Then the judge could have addressed that. Instead, he's evaluating that in the context of what the parties have discussed pre-trial and then making a decision. Do I interject myself into this trial and interfere with how the parties' lawyers have evaluated their cases and how they want to present them? That's a hard thing for the district court judge to do. It's a responsibility of the district court judge, I agree. But, you know, I think you have to look at plain error in the context as to how the issue comes before the judge. And that's the main problem I have with your argument on this is how do we fault the judge for not saying, I got to jump in on my own right now after what the parties have discussed with him?
Yeah, and I think what you're arguing or stating is that...
I'm not arguing not anything. Arguing, I'm asking you a question.
What your comment or question is would be, well, if this isn't in plain error world, we're in plain error world, and that's what we're dealing with, right? We're dealing with the situation that there was a plain error, and at that point, that's what the trial court should have done.
Maybe there was an error, but was it plain? You know, it's not plain error one element. It's plain error. You know, you have to have both of those two things. Lots of error occurs during the trial that the parties don't care about and that a court could constantly interject itself in. So how was it plain to that judge that this is something that I need to stop right now and interfere with how the parties have evaluated their cases?
Well, a couple of things. One is a plain error is whether there is an established standard. 404B requires this. Fields requires this. Williams, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1994, requires this. It's less about what goes on during the trial and more about whether there is an established standard that has been violated. And by the prosecutor not including this, that is the plain error. It's not blaming the trial court. It's not blaming anyone. It's saying that if there is an established law and it's violated, then that is plain error.
So that's the end of the analysis. Respondent argues that this isn't Spiegel evidence, that it's grooming evidence, and so it's not plain error. Do you have a response to that?
Absolutely. I mean, the way this evidence came in was KT testified that Mr. Risk did not show her anything on the phone, that she found adult pornography on the phone. So that evidence certainly can't be grooming evidence because grooming evidence is a defendant showing someone pornography or doing something else. There has to be an act by the defendant. And that evidence was clearly inadmissible in itself, the adult pornography, which is what she testified to, because Judge Redding had specifically ruled that that was not admissible. So at that point, there was no evidence that was related to grooming. He would have had to do something, and he would have had to actually had shown her the photos or the videos or whatever she allegedly saw. So that's why it's not grooming.
Wasn't the way the question was framed different than her answer? So, in other words, wasn't the question framed to ask for grooming evidence, and then she gave an answer that was a little unexpected?
Yeah, I mean, he asked, did Mr. Risk show you anything on the phone? And she said, no. We were searching through the phone ourselves, and we found these pictures of adult pornography. So whether the prosecutor, I mean, and that goes to, you know, our other argument that goes hand in hand with this is that the prosecutor did not prepare his witness, did not know what she was going to testify to. There's no indication that he ever asked her prior to trial in preparation what it was she actually saw, if she saw child pornography or whether it was adult pornography, which the court...
How do we know it wasn't trial strategy and you wanted her to say that?
The defense attorney?
Right.
Well, there was no indication... I mean, well, one, it's prosecutorial misconduct, so defense attorney's conduct has nothing to do with it.
Well, there was no objection, and I guess what I'm getting at is sometimes, having been a trial court judge, too, you know, the volume of testimony and all of the spontaneous matters that come up, I mean, that could be for a reason.
Well, I think that's the purpose of the 404B hearing, the Spiegel hearing they should have had, right? If the defense attorney wants this evidence to come in, you do it before trial when it's such a serious matter. The fact that she testified differently, Mr. Risk's attorney didn't know that was going to happen, didn't cross-examine her, didn't cross-examine any of the other witnesses regarding it. So I don't think that there was any sort of strategy to have her testify differently when he had no idea that was going to take place. I mean, the plain error...
It goes to Judge Flory's comment. You know, the sua sponte injection into a trial by any judge is concerning because we don't know what you're trying to prove. And that somewhat belies your... If there wasn't an objection, it somewhat belies the judge's responsibility to do that, don't you think?
Well, I think, I mean, we are in plain air world, and we're determining whether there's a plain air. And under 404B, they had to abide by this criteria.
So are you arguing then, Mr. Erickson, that as a trial judge is sitting through a trial and he hears someone ask a question that violates the rules of evidence, in every circumstance, a judge should say, whoa, wait a minute, there's no foundation for that. Or wait a minute, that's hearsay. Even if the other side doesn't care? Because it's plain, it's error, violates the rules of evidence. Is it that clear?
Well, I think there are situations where the judge could say, parties, come up to the bench, let's discuss this. Let's make a record of what's going on. I don't think that this hearsay evidence should be coming in. But if you want it to come in, then that's fine, something like that. But I also think what we're talking about right now goes mostly to harm, right? There is error, even in your situations where you're talking about a rule of evidence violation or something else like that that happens all the time. That might be error. But then if they wanted it to come in, then maybe it didn't affect the trial. Maybe it didn't affect the jury's verdict, and the defendant actually did want it in. Here, there's no indication that the defendant wanted any of this evidence to come in. It was highly prejudicial. Mr. Risk's attorney only asked one question about it, and that was on cross-examination of the therapist. He included it in his closing argument, but I think it would have been very ineffective if he didn't make arguments about the inconsistencies, if he didn't do that during during his closing argument, because the prosecutor had injected this child pornography allegation throughout the entire trial and in his closing argument. If he wouldn't have addressed it at that point, it would have been even more prejudicial. While I do think that those might necessarily be plain errors, it might be a different situation that they won't affect necessarily the jury's verdict. Mm-hmm. As far as the harm in this case, it's not a sufficiency standard that we're looking at. We're not looking at if we raise a sufficiency argument or anything like that. It's an impact analysis. What impact is having four different witnesses testify to that Mr. Risk possibly had child pornography on his phone and then focusing a closing argument on the child pornography allegation? What impact would that have on a jury when they're determining if Mr. Risk sexually assaulted a young girl? The risk is very high that was a high impact on the jury's verdict. Also, there was no cautionary instruction. If they would have followed 404B and allowed this in as some sort of Spriegel evidence, the judge would have given a cautionary instruction regarding how the jury could consider this evidence. That wasn't included. The jury could have heard this evidence and said, well, if he had child pornography or if he deleted that child pornography, then he's guilty of this offense. There was no cautionary instruction or limiting instruction at any point during the trial. And again, it's the quantity of the misconduct that really makes this case different than others. We see cases all the time where there might be a witness who testifies to something improper or inadmissible one time. But this is throughout the entire trial. This is something that the jury was asked to determine, and it was completely irrelevant to what the actual questions were that they had to answer. So the impact analysis and not a sufficiency standard is what this court should look to in determining whether Mr. Risk should have a new trial. If this court doesn't have any other questions, I can respond in my rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The appellant here was properly convicted of first-degree criminal sexual conduct for assaulting a 12-year-old girl, and the trial court did not commit plain error by interrupting defense's trial strategy and sua sponte ruling that certain issues should not be admitted. The focus on the Spriegel notice and the 404B, the purpose of Spriegel is to prevent unfair surprise to the defendant, and that comes in this court's case and the Wangley case from 1986. Here, there's no unfair surprise to the defendant. In fact, the defendant raised this issue before trial to talk about how the evidence may come in and specifically address the child pornography to the trial court. The defense had noticed very early on from the police reports and the therapist records that the victim was alleging there was child pornography on the defendant's phone. The defendant was familiar with all of this, had notice, and so under Wangley, any notice deficiency is harmless and not reversible error. This would be admissible. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said in McLeod that grooming evidence is admissible in child sex cases. And so under that theory, it would be admissible evidence.
How would it be admissible, Mr. Schmidt, if the way it came in was that the victim inadvertently discovered it as opposed to being shown that evidence by appellant?
So okay.
That's the way the evidence came in, right?
That's the way the evidence came in, but the way, and this goes to the prepping of the witness argument that appellant is making too, the way that the evidence was in the police reports and in the therapist's records was that the defendant showed her this child pornography on the phone. That goes to the grooming evidence. Even after she testified the way she did, which was a surprise to the prosecutor and not an expected answer, it still could be grooming evidence because the defendant could know that, hey, I've got this on my phone. I know they're going through my photos, and I hope they happen upon this, these photos that are there. And not only that, there was also evidence this was consistent with the state's case. And as we pointed out in a footnote in the state's brief, there was evidence of grooming from the appellant of spanking the victim. And that's at 466 through 69, the transcript. And the appellant told her after spanking her, don't tell anybody. That is consistent with the evidence of grooming evidence with the phone and the spanking. And so under 404B and McLeod, that would be admissible.
Did the jury also hear spanking evidence that Judge Redding or Judge Quam had allowed in an audio format from the phone?
That I don't.
Because it seemed there was. I remember reading somewhere that part of the evidence in the case that was allowed to come in was some spanking evidence on some device involving the appellant. But the judge ruled that you can't see the video, but right. I'll let you play the audio.
Right, correct. And that went to showing his pattern and his history, and that was they didn't want to show, they showed just a snippet or heard just a snippet of the audio of that the appellant or defendant in this case spanked people.
So why wasn't there prosecutorial misconduct involved in not adequately preparing this witness, KT, for her testimony? I mean, it seems to me the two explanations for the change are either that she changed her testimony, but there doesn't seem to be any indication in the record to support that, or that she wasn't properly interviewed prior to testimony so that the prosecutor would know she was going to say, it wasn't a child I saw on there, it was a young adult.
So at least in the record before the court, we don't have the memo that gets disclosed when the prosecutor talks to witnesses and has to disclose it pursuant to Brady. The prosecutor did, in this case, prep that witness, but again, that's not shown in the record before the court. But the evidence that this was a change in testimony is the fact that the therapist reported, when she first reported the child pornography, was consistent with what the state's theory was of how this evidence should come in. Also in the police reports, which was consistent with the state's theory of how this should come in, that this was, in fact, grooming evidence. And so they and the therapist and the police both testified this to this at trial to show that this was something that was grooming evidence and not and her testimony then changed. But again, as you pointed out to the appellant's argument, this is a situation where we're looking to see whether the judge should interject the court should interject in that moment during that testimony and say, whoa, that's a problem. You can't talk about that. It's clear that under Vance and Washington that the trial court has, Minnesota Supreme Court in Washington has instructed trial courts should not interfere with trial strategy because acting sua sponte may highlight something that the defense has tactically decided to waive. That's exactly what happened in this case. It's clear from the pretrial discussions that the defense was aware of these issues, which then again goes to the Sprigo that this is harmless and not reversible. But also, looking at the defense's own closing argument, the entire theme of the defense's case is you can't believe this victim. The child pornography issue goes to that theme because when the police inspected the phone, there were no photographs found on that phone at the time. And the state had a response to that, that the defendant had knowledge of this investigation was going on and he had time to delete evidence, and there was evidence of things being deleted which could not be recovered. And so the defense's theory was, you can't believe her. She's making this up. She even made up the sexual assault allegations, but she also made up this stuff about the child porn found on the phone. There was no child porn found on the phone. And again, in the closing argument, the prosecutor raised it three times during closing argument in passing, and the defendant raised it twice. And in the defense closing, there were six different instances where they said child porn or child pornography.
But the prosecutor raised it first, so...
That's correct.
You know, how can you err, how can you argue that the defense counsel was, it was problematic for the defense counsel to point to that when the prosecuting attorney already raised it in his closing argument or her closing argument?
Because it was part of the defense trial strategy all along, as seen from the pretrial discussions, that they want to ask questions about the child pornography and they weren't found on the phone.
But shouldn't we look at the prosecutor's closing argument on its own? And I mean, that occurred before the defense's closing argument.
Sure, yes, and that is something, when you're analyzing that, and I'm raising the defense's argument here just to show the trial strategy that existed for the defense throughout the trial. But yes, when you're analyzing the closing argument, that is correct. You would look at the prosecutor's closing argument by itself in terms of whether there was misconduct that existed during that misconduct. I'm highlighting the defense's closing now to show this was their trial strategy throughout the entire case, to show that the victim, you can't believe her, which is exactly what they say at 1092 through 93, is about the evidence on this phone was not there and you can't believe her about any of this stuff because she's making all of it up. So this is one of those cases where the Minnesota Supreme Court has been clear that the trial court should not sua sponte interject itself into the case because it could be interfering with tactical decisions that the defense counsel has decided to waive where they otherwise could have objected. And having known about this from the therapist reports and the police reports, raising it pre-trial, and child pornography being a big deal for to come into any case, the defense counsel, had they had any issues with this, would have objected during that the victim's testimony or the therapist's testimony or the police officer's testimony. At any point in time, there were objections that were there to say, hey, keep that out, if it weren't for the trial strategy that the defense had here. So with that, the child pornography admitted was appropriate, or it certainly wasn't plain in the plain error standard, and that goes to the closing argument as well. In terms of the exhibit and the preparation, I think I've covered the preparation, but the exhibit, I'll just rest on the briefs. And unless the court has any other questions, we ask you to affirm.
All right, thank you.
In the state's brief and argument this morning, the theme is that this is somehow defense counsel strategy, and I'm having a really hard time figuring that out, because there's one conversation that takes place pre-trial, and the court asks the defense counsel, any disagreement with prosecutor being able to say on redirect, you looked at the video, you could tell that certain videos were deleted, you don't know what those are. Defense counsel agrees that could happen, only if he is the one who first asks the question of whether there was child pornography found on the phone. The prosecutor's direct examination of the sergeant, he asks, did you find what you would qualify as child pornography on the phone? No, I did not. Were there a number of videos and photographs that had been deleted? There were deleted files on the phone. That pretrial conversation is the only indication that there would be any strategy, and it was only to a very specific situation if defense counsel first opened the door for this evidence. I don't know how that can be a trial strategy for saying we want child pornography to be injected throughout this entire trial, where the one question the jury has to ask is Mr. Risk credible in his testimony that this did not happen and that he did not sexually assault KT?
Well, that's not the question, though. The question for the jury is, has the state proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt? And the law is clear that the jury could, if they believed KT, regardless of all of this, there would be sufficient evidence potentially to support the conviction. So that's really what the issue was, isn't it? So, you know, getting to your, not the sufficiency, but the harm, it seems inconsistencies in KT's statement is the strategy of the defense. And her trial testimony, all of a sudden it says, no, that wasn't child porn. Those were adults on that phone that we scrolled to. Seemed to be a nugget that was handed to the defense in terms of showing inconsistent statements by the victim,
and
alleged victim.
I think that's just a giant assumption that's been created in the state's brief. He doesn't cross-examine KT about that. He doesn't push her. He doesn't ask her any questions about whether she saw child pornography on the phone. He doesn't ask the sergeant any questions about child pornography being on the phone. He doesn't ask Mr. Risk when he testifies. This is all the state bringing this in. Mm-hmm. And there's only one single question, and that's just to clarify to the therapist, what did she say to you? That's it. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand how this can be an entire strategy when it's the most damning evidence you could bring in a child sexual assault case. Mm-hmm. It's really troubling that that is what the state's argument is here, because it's just clearly not supported by the evidence. And this hypothetical conversation that took place between Mr. Risk's attorney and the trial court regarding opening the door for other evidence, this other inadmissible evidence, if he asked a single question, was just a... That could have been strategy as far as what should I do? How do I ask questions without this other stuff coming in? And then defense counsel didn't even do that. He didn't ask any questions on cross-examination regarding what was found on the phone. It was the prosecutor who did it first. And when we're talking about, you know, was this grooming evidence, was this intertwined with the offense, all of these arguments by the state, that's what a 404B Spriegel hearing is for, to determine how this evidence comes in, what's the purpose, is there clear and convincing evidence for it? And none of that took place because we didn't have a hearing. And we can, you know, now we know for a fact that there is not clear and convincing evidence of child pornography, because the state's star witness, the victim, who they were relying on for credibility to prove their case, testified in no uncertain terms, no, he did not show us anything. I looked at the phone, we were scrolling through it, and I saw photos of young adults. And that is specifically what Judge Redding ruled was inadmissible at this trial. So I don't understand the argument regarding a trial strategy, and I don't think that should result in there somehow being that the state does not have to abide by 404B, because later on at a pretrial hearing, a defense counsel asks one question of the judge regarding a hypothetical question of one witness that never took place. So if the court doesn't have any other questions, we request that this court reverse his conviction and remand for a new fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. They were well done. Take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory time.